us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Time to play. CKUT is having a funding drive. CKUT is your community radio supporting events, culture, and shows, and playing the music you wouldn't even know you liked unless you heard it here. Give us a call, 514-907-9424, and give what you can.
In the case of symptoms similar to those of COVID-19, such as fever, cough, sore throat, loss of taste, or smell, you should take a rapid home screening test. If you test positive, isolate yourself at home and please follow the self-isolation instructions. If you don't have a rapid home screening test, please self-isolate for the recommended period. Visit quebec.ca/self-isolating for complete instructions on how to protect yourself and others. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
CKUT, CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT's annual funding drive, CKUT Till Infinity, takes place from March 17th to 27th, 2022.
We have brand new merch available for our donors, including shirts, bags, and hats.
Donations over $30 will also be entered to win from a selection of exciting prizes from our sponsors.
This year's sponsors include
Loofah Farms,
Briar Patch Magazine,
Pop Montreal,
Encore Books and Vinyl,
Drawn and Quarterly,
La Bobineuse,
RIDM,
Mutech,
Centaur Theatre,
CNL Cycle,
La Maison des Bières,
Cinéma du Parc, Beaubien and Dumisey,
Death of Vinyl,
La Rama Records,
Constellation Records,
Celluloid Lunch Records,
and Pizza Bouquet.
CKUT would like to thank our community sponsors whose generous support helps put the fun in funding drive.
For more details on prizes and to donate, go to ckut.ca/donate.
Hello, and welcome to History is Gay, a podcast that examines the underappreciated and overlooked queer ladies, gents, and gentle NBs that have always been there in the unexplored corners of history, because history has never been as straight as you think. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of History is Gay. I have a guest host that is joining me today for a fun episode that we've been working on for quite some time, and I'm really excited to bring them on, and I'm also very grateful to them for dealing with lots and lots of fun time zone craziness, because my wonderful guest is in the Netherlands. So we've been doing a lot of late night, early morning fun things. So welcome everyone to Hannah Van Rie, who is the host and producer of the Queer Sounds podcast. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Lee.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. As you said, it's always fun working with a 9-hour time difference.
Yeah, we've had to reschedule our recording a couple of times because neither of us knows how to math because we are gays. So
absolutely.
Time differences like that can be really difficult, especially when one likes to sleep.
Shout out to everyone in Australia because, 8-hour time difference the other way around,
Oh, God, it's more so. It's so awful. The few times that I've, worked with our good friends over at Queer as Fact, shout out to y'all. It's always been really interesting. Those poor folks came on for a panel that I was doing for work. These poor kids were up at 5 a.m. to do this live streamed panel.
So am I the first European on this podcast?
You might be. I have a couple of things kind of in the, in the back burner with some folks in the UK, but I believe that you are the first European on the podcast. So welcome.
I feel honored.
So I'm really excited to have you here with me to talk about someone that we kind of came up with together And it's going to be really interesting because this is our first episode really covering an entire person who is still around, still alive. We are going to be talking about Wendy Carlos. She is an electronic musician and pioneer in synthesizer music. If you have listened to or watched the films A Clockwork Orange, Tron, you are familiar with her music. We got together and we were like, okay, let's do an episode together on like some queer music. And I can't remember exactly how we came around to this topic, but
I just sent you a random list of people like, have your pick.
There we go. Yes. And it's like, oh yeah, Wendy Carlos, I've seen some cool stuff on her. And it's been really interesting to kind of get to know her story a little bit together. And I really am excited to get to talk with you a little bit about your nerdy backgroundness in music. So to introduce yourself a little bit to folks who are listening who might not be familiar with you and your work and your podcast, Queer Sounds.
All right. Yeah. So my name is Hannah. My pronouns are they, them. I live in the Netherlands. I did a bachelor in journalism with a minor in music, marketing and management. And I am the host of a little podcast called Queer Sounds, all one word, in which I interview other queer people on their taste in music, right? Because everyone likes music, I presume. And especially when it comes to like queer people, I feel like discovering your own taste in music and queer development kind of go hand in hand, like simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Like especially around puberty, you find a vocabulary in that helps you describe your own queerness and gender and whatever. I've got a podcast in which I interview queer people about what songs they like. Which for now is kind of it can be separated into three different categories, like obscure local music, big pop divas, and emo. So yeah, that's the thing.
those are the three genders.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think you reached out to me first and I came on your show, and then it was like, oh, we should do an episode together. And then a year later we finally did an episode together, or however long it's been.
And there is this wonderful saying in Dutch, which goes, wat in het vat zit verzuurt niet, which basically means whatever is in a barrel doesn't go bad.
Ooh, I like that.
So yeah, you know, that applies to different things in different languages as well.
I like that. So yeah, so today we're going to talk a little bit about Wendy Carlos, or as I've been taking to calling her inside my brain, the trans synth queen of my heart. In terms of content warnings for this episode, there's going to be a few. As usual, we will put time codes in the show notes so that you can choose what parts you would like to opt into or opt out of. Content warnings for this episode are going to include discussion of suicidal thoughts, periodical transphobia. We're going to be dealing in the 60s and 70s primarily. And there's also going to be some use of outdated or currently considered defamatory terms. We'll talk about that a little bit. In terms of the format for this episode, it's going to be people focused. So we're going to be going through a bio for Wendy Carlos and then talking about our why do we think they're gay. And then, as usual, we will end the podcast with our how gay were they segment, our personal ranking about how likely it is that they weren't straight. So yeah, Hannah, are you ready to get started and move ourselves out of this little intro space into giving a little bit of context before we dive into the life of Wendy Carlos?
Yeah, absolutely. First, I want to make a little bit of comment, because when you said something that you've been calling Wendy in your brain, I always had to think back of like your Alan Turing episode, because you know we're dealing with tech right. pioneers here, and for some reason it's just been Space Mom.
I you know, I approve of that. I think that Wendy Carlos can share the title of Space Mom with Carrie Fisher. I think that works.
Ooh, yeah, okay.
I think they could be the Space Moms together. There we go.
I feel like Wendy Carlos might be the responsible practical space mom, and then Carrie Fisher would be the fun space vodka aunt.
I was about to say yes, space vodka aunt. Yes. And Carrie Fisher is absolutely a vodka aunt. 1000%. Starting off with our kind of historical context, Hannah's going to go a little bit into the status and landscape of electronic music at the time that we're starting our story, because they are a wonderful genius when it comes to talking about music in a way that I only am able to comment like, I like that. That sounds nice.
All right. So there we go. It's this is very cool because when you think of synthesizers, you tend to think about like the 1970s, 1980s, like the keyboards with the funky sounds. But the first like proto synthesizer dates back as early as the 1890s. There was this one machine called the Telharmonium, which was close to what people in the 1970s could also recognize as a synthesizer, because, you know, at that point, it's just a room-sized behemoth with like a keyboard attached. It was, you know, difficult to move those things around. And another thing Wendy Carlos liked to use was a vocoder, which was invented in like, I mean to say 1928 by a lovely man called Homer Dudley. And the vocoder, you know, being a portmanteau for voice encoder. So, you know, just a way to make your voice digital and electronic.
I just did the brain explodey because I never put that together ever. I'm like, what is vocoder? Oh.
Yeah, no. And you know, to be fair, I'm not entirely sure how much of Wendy's work is actually used by a vocoder, because you've got these different types of machine, right? You've got a vocoder, you've got a talk box, and all of these different machines that kind of fall into the same category of making a voice sound digital. Anyway, as a result of the vocoder, in 1939, the birth year of our lovely protagonist today, during the World Fair in New York, Miss Helen Harper presented Dudley's voice operation demonstrator, or voter for friends and acquaintances, because having discovered a way to encode and transmit speech electronically, Dudley now found a way for machines to produce speech, creating the first voice synthesizer. So with a vocoder, you talk into a machine, and then that, as a result, sounds like digital and machiney. The difference with a voter, so the voice operation demonstrator, is this is just a keyboard, right? It's kind of like Siri or whatever machine can talk back to you, except you can kind of play it like a keyboard. Mm. So it's instead of, I'm not entirely sure if you like type it in, it kind of looked like a regular piano with a bunch of computers attached to it. And then if you play the piano in an appropriate way, you can create sentences and words that kind of sound like a machine is saying it. Think of your tinny robot sound. That's what a voter does. So before Wendy Carlos' first album, synthesizers instruments were mostly, you know, related to more experimental, less commercially successful music, or like in laboratories. An example of that would be, I want to say Kit Baudet or Kit Baudot, is something along those lines. The name slipped my mind for a little bit. And, you know, the reason he was able to produce an electronic album in 1958 was because he worked for a large electronics company and just has the means for it, right? One of the main characters in electronic music in the 1950s was Jean-Jacques Perry, a French dude who released an electronic album in 58. He played a type of proto synthesizer from the 1940s called an ondioline, you know, ond being the French word for waves. And that basically was like playing a game of operation. You know, if you hit the metal with the thing, then it makes a noise. However, this was just way more sensitive. So it got closer to the metal, it would already make a noise. And if you got closer, further away from it at different parts, you would just get different sounds. And with that specific machine, you had a keyboard that would only make one sound at a time, so no chords. However, that keyboard was mounted on springs, meaning the keys could be physically wobbled to create a vibrato effect while playing.
Oh.
And if you have that and add a bunch of filters for a wide array of different sounds, then you can kind of get creative with it. A person that we will encounter later this episode is Usachevsky, a fairly early adapter of the tape recorder as a musical tool. So, you know, actually, like, apart from the machinery, now we're moving on to the way music was recorded. He produced a bunch of tape works throughout the 1950s. He performed at the MoMA together with his friend and colleague Looning in 52, showing off what he could do with tape. So, yeah, that's... a whole lot of information, a whole lot of, you know, technicalities. It's a bit of a mess. It's been a wild ride since 1890.
Yeah.
And that room-sized machine. But yeah, it's our starting point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got some synthesizers that's been around for a while. We've got the different machinery that's already available to make your voice sound wacky and, you know, the way music is being recorded. And from here, all of the information that I've been sharing right now, you can guess that we're in kind of a musical and technological whirlwind of like new possibilities.
Right. And at this point, like, nobody was really using synthesizers commercially. It was like, ah, yes, the folks in their laboratories making, you know, beep boop robot sounds and sound effects and things like that, which is where we're going to be coming in.
That's also because, you know, those machines were still like room sized. You needed to have access to a bunch of different computers and like a apartment size where you could fit those machines, right? So yeah, they weren't accessible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Before we go into our bio, one thing we really wanted to mention is an important note about sources. As I mentioned, this is our first time talking about someone who is still around, other than the one time that I think me and Aubrey Calvin talked about Rodney Powell in our Queers in the Civil Rights Movement episode. So all of the information that you're going to be hearing today, most of it is going to come directly from Wendy's website, wendycarlos.com, so that we can paint as accurate and authentic a picture of her own experiences and feelings directly from her own words. If something doesn't come directly from Wendy's site, it comes from an article or interview that she's listed and linked to on her site, or is one that she actually actively participated in. We do want to acknowledge that there is apparently a biography that was published in 2020 that Carlos herself disavows, saying that, quote, "No one ever interviewed me, nor anyone I know. There's simply no way to know what's true or not. Nothing is firsthand." So if you go out and you want to learn a little bit more about Wendy after this episode, just please be aware that there is, I think, the only book out there published on her, but that she has mentioned on her website that she does not approve of this tome. So take with that what you will. So yeah, let's dive in. Let's start at the beginning, as one usually does. We're going to talk a little bit about the life of Wendy Carlos, starting with her early days in childhood. So she was born on November 14th, 1939, which makes her a Scorpio, as Hannah put in our outline, like a good queer should. And she was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, as the eldest of two. She has a brother who was born 2 years after her. Her parents were both working class, and she came from a family that were already musically talented. Her mother played the piano, and two of her uncles played trombone and trumpet and drums, respectively. Her mother started her in piano lessons at the age of 6, so really early on, and she wrote her first composition at 10, which was titled A Trio for Clarinet, Accordion, and Piano. So already really getting into kind of the classical oeuvre. As a child, she said she, quote, "preferred art and music to rough and tumble play," and that she wasn't good at sports. Early on, she showed talents in graphic arts and the sciences, and you can even see some of her art on her website these days. And she won a Westinghouse Science Fair scholarship in high school for building her own computer at the age of 14. And think about it, this is in the 40s. By this point, it was early 50s.
Building your own computer in 1953, yeah.
Yeah, building your own computer in 1953 is pretty insanely wild. So just think about that is, you know, there was no like PC part picker. You know, as someone who's built my own computer, very different landscape to be able to do that.
Turing would be proud.
Yeah, right? See, now I want to see a conversation between these two. That'd be great. Oh my God.
But wait, I might get my ears crossed, but 53, 54 was Turing around for that? So this could have been a thing that happened, right?
Technically, like, they could have met. Yeah.
Turing opening a newspaper, seeing how this 14-year-old wonder child built their own computer.
Oh, yes. That'd be excellent.
All right, moving on to the college years. She moved to Providence, Rhode Island to attend Brown University in 58. Pursuing a double major in music and physics. While at Brown, she discovered and became infatuated with electronic music and taught informal lessons to other students. She said in a People magazine interview in the 1980s, "I didn't decide, it chased me. I loved all the musical, mechanical, and dramatic things about the field," which sounds like a whole lot of mood.
Yeah.
After graduating from Brown in 62, Carlos moved to New York and pursued an MA in music composition at Columbia University. There she studied with the person we mentioned before, Vladimir Ussachevsky, and his friend Otto Luning at the Columbia Princeton Music Center, the first ever electronic music center in the United States. While at Columbia, she met Robert Moog, an electronic music engineer who was working on the first commercial synthesizer. The Moog synthesizer debuted in 1964 at the Audio Engineering Society show, where she would strike up a friendship and partnership that would span many, many years with her as one of his first clients. Wendy gave Moog essential advice and technical assistance on developing the synthesizer. An article that featured her wrote, "To work a synthesizer most efficiently, one had to be a conductor, performer, composer, acoustician, and instrument builder. And Carlos was all of those. Designer Moog, who manufactured the synthesizers, gives Carlos all the credit. Wendy used techniques that had been available for years, but she just used them better." Then Wendy, in turn, wrote about Moog after Robert Moog's death in 2005. "It was a perfect fit. He was a creative engineer who spoke music, and I was a musician who spoke science. It felt like a meeting of simpatico minds, like he were my older brother, perhaps."
Yeah, so it was kind of a match made in heaven from the start. And I really like that, you know, even though Moog was the first person to, you know, he was creating these machines, he basically gives Wendy all of the credit for being like, well, I mean, I made it, but she's the one who made it into a success.
Yeah.
So going on from Columbia, she graduated from Columbia from grad school in 1965 and assisted Leonard Bernstein in a presentation of electronic music at the Philharmonic Hall. So Leonard Bernstein is a very famous Broadway composer. And after graduation, she got a position as a recording and mastering engineer at Gotham Recording Studios in New York City, as prompted by Ussachevsky. We have a quote from her that says, "I began to know and love New York City. My growing interest in electronic music took a real leap that period. I'd been experimenting with taped music, multiple tracks, that sort of thing, and Professor Ussachevsky made the suggestion that I get a job in a recording studio. I was already beginning to compose, but it was he who suggested I'd support myself by working on the technical engineering side of music." By 1966, Carlos had been working with her own small analog modular Moog synthesizer, which was actually custom built for her by Robert Moog. She basically was like, I want these things on it. And so Bob introduced key sensitivity, components that would trigger chords, and other improvements that Carlos suggested and kind of gave him advice on. And at this time, she was primarily working on recording sound effects and jingles for TV commercials until she met her friend and producer, Rachel Elkind, who will be a large part in her life, in 1967, who convinced her to work on more personal artistic endeavors. And this is where she starts kind of going back into making her own compositions and doing things for her own self-edification rather than working on kind of sound effects and corporate things.
Which brings us to the musical career of it all. You know, she met Rachel, the producer, she met Moog, the entire thing was coming together. So while Carlos recorded several compositions during her time at the Columbia Princeton Electronic Music Center, her true music career began in 68 with the release of her album called Switched on Bach, a collection of Johann Sebastian Bach compositions played on the synthesizer, well known as the most influential synthesizer record of all time. According to keyboard magazine editor Dominic Milano, because this was the first time a album was composed purely through a synthesizer, mm-hmm. or well, not composed, but recorded right. through a synthesizer, because, you know, Bach didn't. Produced by Rachel Elkind, after Carlos had asked her to listen to some recordings she had made with musicologist Benjamin Folkman years before at the EMC. So this was just technically like a casual Elkind saying to Carlos, hey, this sounds neat. You should probably do something with that.
Probably make a whole album.
Exactly.
Yeah. The Switched on Bach album became a huge success that they didn't really expect. And it basically launched the synthesizer into mainstream attention. Because of this album, we have things like disco, like Daft Punk, contemporary electronic music as we know it. This was the thing that made people sit up and go, oh, you can use a synthesizer to do stuff like this? I'm going to buy an album that is classical music on this machine. This really, you know, moved it out of the laboratory space, essentially.
And yeah, so over 1 million copies were sold, as was the first classical album to go to platinum in the US, number one classical charts for 3 years, and peaked at the number 10 on the US Billboard 200. The album won 3 Grammy Awards in 1969, which is insane. Other Grammy winners that year: Joni Mitchell, Quincy Jones, Aretha Franklin, The Beatles, Abbey Road, which, you know, technically won in the Best Engineered Album Non-Classical, which is, you know, the Switched on Bach won the classical counterpart of. Fun little thing, the Beatles, Abbey Road, the Beatles themselves had huge fights while recording Abbey Road, which is famously known. But part of those fights was because Paul McCartney just kept on playing with a Moog synthesizer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Especially during the song Maxwell Silver Hammer.
That, like, makes sense.
Paul just kept on playing the synthesizer, having fun with it, and everyone else was like, Jesus Christ, take it down a notch and just do what you're told. And
which, I mean, I guess it makes a lot of sense that these are, you know, these are debuting and getting recognized in the same year. That's, I wonder if Paul McCartney listened to Switched on Bach.
Probably.
That would make sense.
Yeah, and from there it's just, oh, fancy shiny new toy, let's annoy everyone,
right,
the fuck with,
right,
that.
Yeah. And I mean,
wait, can I say that here?
Oh yeah, you could say whatever you want. This is a swearing, right, friendly podcast. We discovered this in our first ever episode where we just realized we couldn't stop saying fuck, so I have that.
Right,
I have that lovely little E on our Apple Podcasts, whatever it is, iTunes. Yeah, I mean, like, using this synthesizer, each individual element, like, I don't think that we've gotten across exactly how difficult it was at this time to make electronic music. Like, each element had to be layered and tracked individually in the studio with, like, one hand, like, adjusting controls and filter, while the other hand is, like, doing melody on a keyboard. The synth had to be, like, tuned before each take, and you just kind of cross your fingers that it stayed in tune by the end of that take. It's mesmerizing to think, like, how long did it take to produce, like, just a few minutes of music. It's not real time like it would be if you were, you know, just composing on, like, a keyboard.
Yeah, it's probably like months and months of work. I don't know. I wasn't around for it. And to be honest, I'm glad we can just, like, press a microphone here and have the different layers without any trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, after the Switched on Bach's commercial success, she released a follow-up album called The Well-Tempered Synthesizer in November 69, this time with pieces from multiple composers, I want to say including Beethoven. The success of those albums allowed Wendy to move in together with Rachel Alcand in her NYC home, living together and creating a studio space there. And to latch on what you said about how much of a work it was, like, we would love to share some music, or at least be able to listen to music, but our dear protagonist for today, she is such a perfectionist that most of the stuff isn't even available online because it doesn't meet her audio quality standards. Mm-hmm. So, you know, think about all of the work that had to be done in 1968, 69, because something is just not up to the level where she wants to have it. Like, I bet that must have gotten a lot of retakes.
Yeah. Well, and we will also, in our notes on the website, we link to where you can go and purchase the albums if you'd like to listen to them. And there's also a little bit of music on Spotify, which goes along with what we're going to transition into right now, which is talking about movie work. With the success of her first two albums, she attracted the attention of Hollywood, understandably. In 1971, Stanley Kubrick was beginning production on A Clockwork Orange, which was an adaptation of the book by Anthony Burgess, and Rachel Alcand got in touch with Kubrick's lawyer. She had some connections from working for Columbia Records. She was a secretary for Columbia at the time. And so she got in touch, reached out to Kubrick's lawyer, and suggested Wendy Carlos and her synthesizer to score the movie. She was basically saying, hey, you're producing this really novel and interesting film. Why don't you think about synthesizer as a way to kind of complement that? As Elkin said, I sent him Switched on Bach and The Well-Tempered Synthesizer. Kubrick's assistant called a few days later. He asked if we could come to England immediately. 2 days later, we were on a flight. So it was like an instant, yes, this is exactly what we're looking for. The New York Times called Carlos's score, which utilized vocoders to create a really haunting chorus of artificial voices in her versions of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, quote, a giant step past the banalities of most contemporary film tracks. This was one of the first times human voices kind of had been imitated electronically, and so initially everyone was kind of scared about it. Like, test audiences were kind of freaked out. You know, they weren't sure it was going to come off well. Carlos actually said, we got a lot of uncomfortable reactions. People looked at us and said, oh my goodness, what is this? They were scared by it. And I mean, when you listen to it, if you've ever seen A Clockwork Orange, it's a fantastic film, but really disturbing. And so you have this kind of, in some ways, uncanny valley quality to the soundtrack, because you have these human voices that are not quite human, and this classical sound going through, but there's just something off about it.
Deeper than that, it also matches, right? Because it's supposed to set in like some imagined version of the future, so using technology in that way really fit it. But at the same time, the entire arrogance of the main characters in Clockwork Orange, that also really matches the cultural superiority people tend to feel when they listen to a lot of classical music. In that sense, everything just lined up perfectly for that music to go with that movie.
Yeah, it really kind of changed the game in terms of music scores.
Yeah, and also in the general, this movie, if memory serves me right, was released in 72, right? So if you're thinking of the charts, what bands were there? Like, we've had the last few albums by some last few post-passing of Jim Morrison Doors albums, you know, some last collaboration or a compilation album by the Beatles. And from there, we moved into like the prog rock side of things. So, you know, music itself was also getting more experimental, in which because of that, I feel like they might have been willing to take the risk of getting Carlos to write this make this movie soundtrack. Like the Pink Floyd of it all and like all of that entire landscape, the first few albums by Supertramp, music itself was already getting more experimental. Carlos just matched that development perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm kind of lost track with different music things there, but more movies and more music during the 1970s and 1980s. Carlos kept on releasing albums, though she gradually moved away from reworking classical pieces into composing her own work. The first album, which with its own compositions, was Sonic Seasonings, a album with four tracks loosely inspired by the Four Seasons, with field recordings and ambient sounds from nature. And there is a different person who had already done that at the time, albeit not an album technically, and also not a recording. But, you know, if we're talking about a piece of work inspired by the Four Seasons, we got to mention Vivaldi. Like, obviously, that is still in, like, the ballpark of classical music. So Sonic Seasonings started in 1970 and was finished mid-1971 while she was working on A Clockwork Orange, which, you know, is a huge lot of work for one person to fit in that short a time. And also, she predated ambient and environmental music way before New Age was ever a thing. Kyle Dixon, one of the composers for Stranger Things, said the album was the first ambient album, essentially. It came before Tangerine Dream's Sight or Brian Eno's Discreet Music, so she really was ahead of the curve on this one. Carlos reunited with Stanley Kubrick for a foray into horror music for The Shining in 1980, although in the end they only ended up using two tracks credited to Carlos and Elkind, which I think are the two tracks that can be found on Spotify, right?
Yeah, they're the two tracks that can be found on Spotify. And there's actually, we don't have time to really go into all of it here, but there's actually a really interesting story about her experience working with Kubrick for The Shining and how she and Rachel had produced a whole bunch of different tracks, and Kubrick got really hung up on this other idea and there was a lot of disappointment in that they ended up going in a different direction. You can read all of that in one of the sources that we're going to put on our in our show notes. It's really interesting to kind of see what that experience was like. And it seems like there was a lot of drama going on. But, you know, in the end, we got probably the two most like distinctive tracks and haunting, in my opinion. Like I listened to the opening title several times while writing this outline.
I'm just kind of stuck on why it's specifically these two tracks that are available to listen to, because the way we've got to know Carla's while researching this, I feel like it's probably not her choice to make those tracks, put those tracks available to listen to. Like, it might be because of legal issues with the movie production side of it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it, you know, also with the other tracks that are available on Spotify, which go along with her next movie foray.
Yeah, exactly. So the other movie you mentioned was 1982's Tron. She combined symphonic orchestral music from the London Philharmonic, UCLA Chorus, and Royal Albert Hall Organ with her synthesizers for this movie. A article from Music Museum of New England states, while strikingly different in content and tone, the music for both A Clockwork Orange and Tron is trademark for Carlos. Illustory yet honest, spastic yet static, urgent yet emotive. So by this time, we're talking 1980s, Elkind had moved away to France to live with her husband, and Carla stayed in New York City with her new business partner, Anne-Marie Franklin, in a converted loft and studio. It was enclosed in a freaking Faraday cage. Okay, I'm just...
Yes. Yeah, she's still in this studio, I believe. It was enclosed in a Faraday cage, which is like a metal or wire cage that shields electronic equipment from radio and TV signals from outside and like reduces white noise. I really love like how metal is that to be like, I'm going to enclose myself in a literal force field from outside sounds. And she and her friends call her studio the spaceship, which is so great. There's we'll put notes for it in the show notes, but in a Keyboard magazine article that we read, there is like an entire section talking about her basically custom designed studio, the spaceship, and like there's blueprints. It's triangular, and you know, she's like, I know that it takes up a whole bunch of space and it's super weird, but it produces the best sound.
Right. I just love that entire article so much. Like, why would you put that keyboard or why would you put that synthesizer in the middle of the room? That's like not feng shui or whatever. It's like, well, that's just where I get the best noise with my speakers that are there, and there. Mm-hmm. It's just, it also really shows how much of a perfectionist Carlos is, and I love her for it.
I love the just the sheer music nerdiness of like in this Keyboard magazine, they spend an entire like 2-page spread going over the like technical intricacies of the design of this studio, and it's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Wendy released more studio albums in the 1980s. We wanted to highlight two here. There's Digital Moonscapes, which came out in 1984. And this was her first album to feature only digital synthesizers. So we've moved from analog to digital, you know, moved from actually like manipulating, you know, like a switchboard and being able to, you know, produce things on computers. And it combined her love of electronic music with her passion in astronomy, which, you know, you could tell is probably a big thing considering they call her studio the spaceship. We have a quote here, the 9-movement Moonscapes Suite, inspired by the major moons of the solar system, is performed by what Carlos calls a digitally synthesized orchestra. And for it, she electronically created over 500 voices, quote unquote, that replicate different instruments. So Moog actually has a quote where he says, Wendy has built up lyrical sounds nobody ever heard coming out of a digital synthesizer before. Nobody is in her league, which I think is just like a big theme here is, you know, hey, people were doing these things before potentially or using this equipment and nobody was able to do it the way that she was.
And, you know, because we're talking about the 1980s here, you know, by the time the technological development has made synthesizers available to public, right? So after the big room-sized synthesizers, Moog now also has a mini Moog, which we also know from like artists like Kraftwerk and all of those electronic artists from the 70s. And yet, even though a lot of artists now have access to synthesizers, I mean, we're talking 80s at this point, so you know that the synthesizer all around, she still manages to stay ahead of the curve.
Right. Yeah. She followed Digital Moonscapes up with an album called Beauty in the Beast in 1986. And this is where we see her experimentation with alternate scales and musical tunings and kind of microtonality, which I don't understand, but she's very, very passionate about it. In this, she combined music from non-Western and quote-unquote old world cultures with new ideas like microtonal scales that she created just for the album. And she personally considers Beauty in the Beast one of the most important albums of her career, because she finally was able to really dig into alternate scales, which was a passion of hers for a long time.
Do you want me to elaborate on the scales a little bit?
Yeah, go for it.
So, you know, the way scales work, right, is we usually have these 8 standard notes with like the semi half notes in between. Like the sharps and the flats and all that stuff, which is majorly the Western way we in Europe and the US notate music. However, there are different versions you can do this. Like there are different scales. The most popular one, I think, at least in my general periphery, would be Arab music. So if you listen to artists like, if you listen to artists from like Turkey, like Bülent Ersoy, then you'll find that their scales are just kind of working differently because, you know, apart from the regular notes with halves, you also go into like quarters, and in that way, you know, microtonal scales are created. So the way our scale system works, that would just sound like an off pitch scale, right? That would just be an off scale, off pitch note. However, in different scales, that would actually just be its own proper note halfway through. Because, you know, nothing is real. Everything is relative. And once again, we think the Western way to do it is the correct way, where there are actually a lot of different ways to do things.
You know what? This seems like a good place to put in our favorite jingle.
Fuck colonialism.
I wasn't sure that we were going to be able to work that one in for this episode, but you did it very well. Good job.
You know, every chance to slam colonialism is another one.
Yeah. And then we have what is probably my favorite, most unexpected thing ever, is in 1988, she collaborated with Weird Al, Al Yankovic, on a parody album of Peter and the Wolf. Which, you know, kind of let her, as she said, to let her sense of humor out of the cage. And in it, they rearranged the music of Peter and the Wolf with a MIDI orchestra. And so this was nominated for a Grammy for Best Album for Children in 1989. And I don't think that it won, but the fact that it was nominated and that she just got to hang out with Weird Al and make a fun parody classical album was really fun.
Moving on to the 1990s, we're moving on to era in time in which I was actually born. Wendy re-recorded Switched On Bach in 1992 for its 25th anniversary as Switched On Bach 2000. That just seems appropriate considering how ahead of everything she always was. 1992, let's call it 2000, seems about right. this time she used digital instruments and recordings to bring it into the modern era. Her most recent studio album, Tales of Heaven and Hell, was released in 1998, combining, again, I quote, themes from A Clockwork Orange with a dark and forbidding goth mass. She spent the next 5 years remastering her entire back catalog with extra bonus material and notes, and designing and constructing a custom hybrid musical assembly with the 4 manual Wurlitzer II, as she mentions on her website.
Yeah. And again, there's like an entire segment in one of the Keyboard Magazine articles about how she's been developing and constructing this new piece of machinery. Wendy was presented with the Seamus Life Achievement Award in 2005, and that's SEAMUS, standing for the Society for Electroacoustic Music in the United States, which is a great acronym. And she has delivered several papers at conferences and institutions, including NYU, Audio Engineering Society's Digital Audio Conference, and a whole bunch more. She released an album, Recovering Lost Scores, in 2005, which contains previously out-of-print material of hers, including her soundtrack to the British movie Woundings, and she also included in this Rediscovering Lost Scores all of the music left out of her other film scores. So she has, like, a huge catalog of things that just weren't used in those films, and so she decided to kind of put them into this album. She hasn't spoken publicly or given interviews since before 2010, with much of her own personal website updates kind of slowing down around 2009. Her last published interview was in 2007, and currently she's 81 years old and lives a quiet life in New York with several dogs and cats. I mean, like, every picture that you see kind of coming out from her recently is, like, her in front of her synthesizers and keyboards and everything with, like, a cat on her shoulder. There are, like, 3 pages of pictures and stories on her website with, you know, information about all of her dogs and cats over the years, and I really, really love that dedication. Her website is so dense and amazing. It's 16-bit friendly, and it's like a great archive of, like, early internet culture, too. Yeah, You read an interview from 2001 where they only got 3 questions in before they started talking about the cats, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, okay, tell us about the cats, though. Or, like, some cat jumped on the lap and then the conversation just shifted.
Yeah, there was one interview where somebody was talking about how she called them at, like, 1 a.m. when one of the cats was having kittens, and they talked for, like, 3 hours about the cats, which was great. Wendy has not really done a lot of updating to her website or appearing since the 2009-2010 until, you know, she came and put that update on her website last year with the publication of the new book, so 2020. She's also an accomplished solar eclipse photographer, and her work has been published online by NASA, and her photos have even appeared on magazine covers. She's basically traveled all over the world to photograph astronomical objects, and so if you want to see some of her solar eclipse photography, you can visit her website. So before we move into our next segment, we just wanted to kind of present a couple of, like, loose thoughts from Wendy in, you know, articles or interviews or on her website. We just wanted to share some of these delightful quotes.
Right.
So we'll switch off.
Switched off Bach, if I'm
there you go.
If I can be so free to make that joke. So the first one we've got written down here is, the greatest thing we've got going in our culture is our eccentrics. I was once embarrassed by my eccentricities, but now I value them. Moving on from like the actual music that was being developed at the time, and guessing from this, I think this is like late 70s.
Yeah, this is like 79.
79, yeah. So there she says, vocoders are becoming a cliche. You hear the Star Wars sounds, Battlestar Galactica music, and the aliens usually talk with a vocoder. So once again, I think we were a little too early. Like, this is Wendy being aware of how much of an early adapter she actually was.
Right, and how freaked out people were at the, like, electronic voices in A Clockwork Orange. Mm-hmm. I think she was specifically talking about that, about how people were kind of scared. And now, you know, years later, it's like, well, you know, vocoders are now just kind of passe and cliche at this point. What I really loved reading about her own philosophies with music is she talked a lot about how, you know, regardless of the tools that you're using, it's still about practice and form and having the skills and not necessarily, you know, needing natural talent, but that if you put in the work, you could develop the skills. So she says, in the case of the tools of computerdom, the canvas and the colors are different, but the steps of making great music are still the same steps. Form is still the biggest bugaboo in any piece of music longer than a minute or two. She also goes on to say, somebody was quoted as saying that there were going to be so many more Beethovens now, thanks to the new technology. It's wanton lies. That is not true. Art comes from creative people doing a job well. Some part of it is a gift, in which case you could take no bows for it. Other parts, it's just pure sweat work, in which case you can take a bow for it. There was a lot of people, you know, saying like, ah, well, now that anybody can, make music in their bedroom, there's going to be so many people who do it. And, you know, she really was like, well, I mean, you know, it's making it accessible for people, but you still have to put in the work.
I guess if we want to draw a parallel now, it probably goes for podcasters.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The amount of times the amount of times we had that conversation, it's like, okay, but you still need to like actually put in some work and, you know, think critically about what you're putting out there. I say to, you know, every three white dudes talking about movies and drinking beer podcast out there. It's fine.
So in one interview, she also mentioned what records she listens to at home, where she mentioned ELP, so Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. However, when the conversation shifted to the digital music or electronic music landscape at the time, it's nice to know, she says, that synthesizers have been used in disco, but it would have been healthier for the industry had it not been. If you're asking me to name the hit disco singles, I can't, since I generally flee from anything that repeats the same sequence more than 16 times, which is just wonderfully nerding. Like, yeah, no, I can't listen to the same bars too often. She continues, but I know I sound scholarly and tight-assed and pompous. It's making me sad.
She doesn't like a good hook. I know. Yeah. Yeah. You're not gonna catch Wendy Carlos out here listening to, you know, basic pop.
But I also feel like, you know, she also undermines the power pop and disco can have. Because it's absolutely because of disco and prog artists like Electric Light Orchestra that used a vocoder and then moved into disco. It's artists like those who actually made people not afraid of the vocoder anymore.
Right, right, yeah. So yeah, that's what we've got on what Wendy is currently up to, at least as far as we know. And so now we want to get into the gay stuff. Y'all have, you know, listened to us talk a lot about Wendy's career and her musical prowess. And now we're going to switch into our Why Do We Think They're Gay segment. So we've been really deliberate and careful about, you know, how we're presenting Wendy's story. For the first 10 years of her career, she actually published her works and albums under a different name and identity, even amid her enormous success with Switched on Bach and A Clockwork Orange. It was only in 1979 that she publicly came out of the closet as a trans woman, through an interview, oddly enough, at least to me, in Playboy magazine. Much of the description of her experience and gender transition journey comes from this Playboy article. And so what we really wanted to do is kind of present her, you know, her whole story in terms of her career and her life, and then kind of separate out these elements. A journalist named Sam Manzella in a New Now Next article writes that since her initial coming out, Carlos has rarely addressed her gender identity in interviews. That may have something to do with the way her story has been told. Even after she discussed her transition in great detail, reporters and editors continued to print her dead name. Hence, we will not be mentioning her dead name here and have not, and we've striven to present her life and career based on her accomplishments and musical prowess, as I said, before even getting to discuss her gender. But we do want to acknowledge how absolutely trailblazing her coming out was. We have a quote here that says, in 1970s America, it was not only unheard of, but potentially career-ending move, not to mention dangerous. And so, you know, if you are doing research on Wendy Carlos, you will see her dead name out there. We are choosing not to mention it at all because that's shitty. So yeah, so we're going to kind of break this next segment up into two sections. We're going to talk about the gender of it all and then the sexuality of it all. And most of, like we were saying, most of the information that we know about her own kind of gender journey comes from this Playboy article. So we take some of that with a grain of salt, and we'll be talking about that article at length.
So, Carlos knew she was trans from an early age. She describes, I was about 5 or 6, and I remember being convinced I was a little girl, much preferring long hair and girls' clothes, and not knowing why my parents didn't see it clearly. I didn't understand why they insisted on treating me like a little boy, but I wanted them to love me, and I felt that if I behaved the way I wanted to, I would lose their love. So I began hiding my feelings from a fairly, very early age. And this quote just like tore me to pieces.
Yeah.
It's A, very relatable, but also B, very sad. She also reflected that she used to steal her mother's clothes and wear them to bed. And when her parents caught her, they'd make excuses like, that name is just practicing for Halloween. She describes the disconnect between her internal sense of gender and what she was experiencing in her body. She says, I'd draw pictures of myself, very accurate portraits of my face, and then erase the short hair and draw longer hair along with a touch of lipstick to see how I'd look as a woman. And, you know, she is a very good artist. Like, if you want to see some of her art, like drawings we are managed, you mentioned, you can see on her website. So, you know, she is very intense about this, how she would look. She preferred playing with other girls in the playground as a child, which would result in plenty of raspberries from more than tight-ass boys, as Carlos put it. And she experienced other harassment from students at school that we don't need to go into great detail about.
Yeah. She gets pretty detailed in the Playboy article, but
that's nothing but triggery mess. As many trans people might relate to, puberty started and she found it harder to suppress her feelings and start to struggle with her mental health. At some point during my teenage years, she says, I tried to pretend these feelings didn't exist. I told myself I didn't have all of those inclinations, that it was straight, normal. By late adolescence, as I started to become more masculine, I began to hate my body. She says, it sounds so mad, doesn't it?
So, I mean, even she can, you know, see the kind of pointlessness of such, you know, self-deprecation, but it's the case. When she moved into kind of her college years, she struggled even more with dysphoria in college and described it as anguish as it became harder and harder to suppress those feelings. And this, this description of her dysphoria breaks my heart. So, I mean, like this whole segment, just, you know, trigger warnings for very dysphoric feelings. She says, I felt set apart. I felt that nature had made a mistake. That's a cliche, but that's how I felt. Extreme confusion. From time to time, I was able to repress it, and I don't know, maybe I thought that I'd close my eyes and then suddenly wake up and find I was a woman. Ugh.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. There's no other way to put it.
Yeah.
So here we've got a little content warning for suicidality. So press that skip button if you think that it's necessary. As a graduate student at Columbia in 1962, her depression worsened and she began to experience increasingly suicidal feelings. So she decided to pursue her transition and made a list of the things I needed to do with my life if I was going to survive. At the top of that list was to find a doctor someplace who would help me change my sex. So yeah, she just that specific, if I was going to survive. Like, that's a very, I want to say, practical way to put it, but it mm-hmm. does show how bad her depression actually had gotten at that point.
Yeah. And at the time, you know, Carlos was just beginning to learn and acknowledge that she may not actually be the only person with these experiences and feelings. And I think that really points to the extreme importance of knowing where we come from and seeing other people in our past. So she actually became familiar with the story of Christine Jorgensen, who was an American trans woman who was actually the first person to become essentially a media sensation after her transition and gender affirmation surgery in the 1950s. If you've ever seen, and we'll do a whole episode on her at some point, but there's a whole headline and newspaper spread that's like XGI becomes American Beauty or something like that. And that's Christine Jorgensen. And so she was really one of the first trans people that became a household name, at least in the US. The turning point for her in, you know, kind of pursuing her transition came in 1967 when she read The Transsexual Phenomenon by Dr. Harry Benjamin, which she said, quote, gave me a little more courage to accept myself and stop suppressing my feelings. And indeed, it proved an explanation for all the alienated feelings I'd had since my earliest memories. So this really allowed her to kind of create a context for what she was feeling, thanks to this sexologist, Harry Benjamin. She, that same year, reached out and made an appointment with the Benjamin Foundation. And after multiple consultations, she began hormone therapy as a starting point by early 1968. Together with the doctors, they started with discussing various methods of addressing her dysphoria and, quote, condition, and kind of putting all the pieces together. She said in this Playboy article, at first I was confused. I thought I had to come up with physical proof. So physical proof for, like, you know, what was going on, some biological imperative to, this is why I feel like I need to change genders. But she says, but then I realized the proof was within myself. The only evidence I had was the history of my feelings. The overwhelming need I had was to resolve the conflict and become the person I had to be. That was my evidence. And I think that this is really significant, saying like, look, like your feelings and your internal compass, that is your proof. That is enough, you know, especially at this time where gender, you know, gender dysphoria is considered a condition, a medical problem, something maybe hormonally wrong with you, that you want to change genders, that you, you know, are wanting to change your body. And so I thought that that was a really, really significant quote from her. She also apparently interacted with some other trans folks in what she called a kind of transsexual underground, mostly around doctor's offices. You know, people would kind of share stories and, you know, swap suggestions, but she didn't really get very involved in the community. She wanted to remain stealth and protect her career. And, you know, she really was more concerned with just like going in with her doctors and, you know, working on the medical and transition parts of this. So she wasn't so aware of clubs and bars where she might meet other trans folks and get involved with the community.
Yeah, I was reading this interview and I was thinking, wait, what's the timeline of this all, right? Because Wendy might be the only queer person in New York in 1969 that's so introverted that she was completely oblivious to, you know, some specific queer places that may or may not have gained some notoriety in that time.
Yeah, maybe, you know, one that is very famous for being a huge catalyst for kicking off the queer and trans rights movements, but, you know, specifically in that year, but whatever.
Yeah, just bars. Nah, I'm just going to stick in my spaceship. I'm fine. I'm good.
Right. Yeah, I love it. I mean, that's a very relatable feel. Like from one of the quiet gays, I feel that. I'm like, I don't want to go to a bar. I just want to like hang out in my pajamas and be queer and trans while eating popcorn on my couch.
I mean, as much as I like a fun night with alcoholic beverages, I also prefer like, okay, you know what, my friends, come to my house and we'll drink beer and we'll listen to some fun bleeps and bloops that I made.
Yes.
My name is Alia. I'm at CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Mandla, your weekly news show with briefings and analysis from the continent of Africa, from a progressive Pan-Africanist point of view. And I'm Doug Miller, here with Gwen Schulman. Gwen Schulman.
Except here, this time, is we are in Malawi, not in Montreal, and you're about to listen to a rebroadcast because Doug and I are away for Malawi, 1 month, actually. And in the time that we're there, we hope to do some great radio so that when we're back home in Montreal, there's going to be some good, fresh interviews for all of you to listen to. But in the meantime, we've picked some of our favorite shows from the last year to rebroadcast while we're away.
So stay tuned.
So tonight's show is a very special show. While, of course, we're rebroadcasting because Doug and I are currently in Malawi, what we're missing and we're sad to be missing is the fundraising show. It's always been a special time of year for us at Amandla. Why? Because we love CKUT and we love the fact